This is an ABC podcast.
Kam na panani Māori, kam waranakai. Te pon ai, pon te bong, ai re rangi re kahawaki. Ana bon bong te wiki, te taitai ne Kiribati. That's right, it is Kiribati Language Week. So we want to thank you for tuning in to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. Arau ngai e ki tupo. Well, coming up on the show, the divide over seabed mining in the Pacific sees leaders gather in Kingston, Jamaica. What will the Melanesian agreement mean for the women of Bougainville? And we'll be crossing to the Solomon Islands as today is Independence Day. Stay tuned for that and more, but before we begin, we'd like to give acknowledgement that our show comes to you from the lands of the Boonwurrung and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation, paying respects to elders past and present. I say korabwa. Thank you for tuning into Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific. We begin with delegates from around the world, including those on both sides of the deep sea mining divide in the Pacific, have arrived in Kingston, Jamaica to attend the 30th session of the International Seabed Authority Assembly and Council, which begins today. The gathering comes hot on the heels of the delivery of new research into the potential environmental impacts of mining the seabed, and a matter of months after Donald Trump signed off on an executive order designed to open up US and international waters to mining companies. So now, as Lucy Cooper reports, with pressure mounting on the ISA, the hope is they will move closer to finalising regulations for deep sea mining in international waters at last.
Deep sea mining, a controversial and at times divisive topic in the Pacific, where Nauru, Kiribati, Tonga and the Cook Islands are looking likely to proceed with it, Palau, Fiji, Samoa, Vanuatu, Tuvalu and the Marshall Islands are cautious and for some, completely opposed to it.
The Pacific Islands are the big ocean states. Their area of livelihood is much bigger in the water, into the water, than on land.
That's Leticia Cavallo, an oceanographer by training, who is the Secretary General of the International Seabed Authority, or ISA.
The deep sea bed needs rules, and the ones that will benefit more of collective rules are the ones that have vast water mass, and the Pacific people will benefit more than others.
The past 6 months in the world of deep sea mining has been very interesting. At the start of the year, the ISA, which has prevented deep sea mining in international waters, while it works on governance frameworks, elected Ms. Cavallo as its new Secretary General. In April, Donald Trump signed an executive order to accelerate the development of seabed mineral resources in domestic and international waters. Soon after, the metals company, a frontrunner in the efforts to mine the seabed, decided to look beyond the ISA and instead lodge an application with the US regulator to begin commercial mining. And just last week, Australia's National Science Agency, the CSIRO, released a report which outlines a way to assess the environmental impacts of deep sea mining. Here's Senior Principal Research Scientist Dr. Piers Dunstan explaining the significance of it.
Our goal and the work that we have done sets a standard for a really robust analysis of deep sea communities and deep sea mining, so that if deep sea mining does occur, it'll be underpinned by science-based management and monitoring. We feel this is a very relevant report. It is the first integrated assessment that anyone's ever done of the deep ocean in this particular way.
The metals company commissioned and paid for the research. CEO Gerard Barron said he was pleased with its findings.
It's a report that is pragmatic, and it shows that you can create thresholds where you can safely go and collect these polymetallic nodules and stay within thresholds and not cause any serious harm.
Phil McCabe of the Deep Sea Conservation Coalition, which advocates for a moratorium on deep sea mining, also welcomes the findings of the report because, for him, it affirms that major knowledge gaps still exist in the industry.
The report really underlines the need for a moratorium, really, because the underlying reality is reiterated here that very little is known about the deep sea ecosystems where this mining is planned, and therefore our ability to fully predict and understand the scale, scope and severity of impacts is limited.
Mr McCabe said that the metals company is attempting to spin this report in a favourable way to boost investor confidence. Mr Barron denies this is the case.
There's no spin required. Maybe the other side are starting to wake up to the fact that we're entering a period of trade-offs. You know, there is no such thing as zero impact. We can't just magic up critical minerals and put them into our supply chain. They have to come from somewhere.
The ISA's Secretary General, Letitia Kavalu, has faced mounting pressure from proponents like Gerard Barron to deliver the mining code, the regulations and procedures for how deep sea mining should proceed in international waters.
The International Seabed Authority has been around for more than 30 years, and they have failed to deliver on the one thing they had to do, and that was put a legal framework in place to allow the exploration and the exploitation of these seafloor resources.
At the same time, opponents to deep sea mining, like Phil McCabe, are calling for its delivery to not be rushed.
If humanity wants robust regulations, then humanity has to wait.
Ms Kavalu refutes criticisms that delays to these regulations have been because of activists.
I particularly don't embrace this logic, and the exercise of developing the rules and regulations also encompasses standards and guidelines. So it's not a simple, trivial process that can be delivered quickly. In 2023, there was consensualized, I can say in this way, roadmap issued as a decision by the Council that made a promise that member states would do the best efforts and intentions aiming to deliver the mining code by the end of the 2025. So as Secretary General, I fully trust on the ambition of the member states and of the Council.
Phil McCabe believes it's unrealistic to expect that the mining code will be delivered by the end of this year.
In real terms, I don't see the regulations being close to being finished for another 2 to 3 years minimum.
Gerard Barron says the uncertainty with when the ISA will deliver the code is part of the reason that his company turned to the US regulator, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, to lodge an application to commence deep sea mining. Ms Kavalu says this decision could lead to a wild, wild west in international waters.
I would, in a free manner, say that we are opening a Pandora box that is going to be very difficult to be closed because collective action takes a lot of time to take shape.
It's a complicated situation, but the metals company decision essentially sidestepped the authority of the ISA because the US is not a party to the law of the sea, which established the ISA. And it's not a decision Ms Kavalu is concerned by.
It's a dormant regime that has been in place and was tested a few times. I must say that I'm aware that US law was subject of 4 applications. 2 were withdrawn over time, and it still remains with 2 applications that never really delivered its full ambition.
Gerard Barron says Ms Kavalu's comments are far from his truth.
I don't care what the Secretary General thinks. And for someone who oversees a body that's been around for 30 years trying to put in place a set of rules, to judge an organisation that has had the rules in place since 1980, come on. I mean, I hope she looks in the mirror and has a good look at herself, because that's a ridiculous comment.
Whilst the war of words may continue, the US executive order means the race towards commercial mining has already started.
That report compiled for Pacific Beat by Lucy Cooper. Now that Papua New Guinea's Prime Minister James Marape and Bougainville's President Ismail Toroama have signed the Melanesian Agreement, hopes of an end to the deadlock in independence continue to rise. The new agreement outlines a pathway to the endorsement of the 2019 referendum by the PNG Parliament. More than 97% of Bougainvillians voted in favour of breaking away from PNG, and Helen Hakena, the Executive Director of the Autonomous Region's Women's Development Agency, says the new deal carries great meaning for the women of Bougainville in particular.
It brings us a step closer to our independence. We were really happy about the signing of this Melanesian Agreement, in New Zealand, because it defines our way forward, our political journey for Bougainville in gaining independence. We are very, very happy with that. And we are also happy that both governments are collaborating to bring this and dialogue, you know, with one another. And the Melanesian agreement signals real progress on Bougainville's peace agreement. We had our peace agreement in 2021 and our process towards our independence. So we are very happy. It means a lot to us, the people of Bougainville. We are also happy with the Papua New Guinea government. Like, its constitution gives us, the people of Bougainville, the right to determine our future. And we also would like both governments to listen to women's voices, to be inclusive, because the women have paved the way for peace, because we lost 20,000 lives to be honored, those lives lost to be honored by granting us our independence. If Papua New Guinea does not give us our independence by 1st September 2027, we do not want any relapse into conflict, because our people are looking forward to our independence on that day.
When we talk about the Melanesia Agreement, what was, I suppose, achieved with this agreement? How is it a meaningful step forward in that path to independence?
It is very meaningful to us because both governments went together, New Zealand, to sit and meet, whereas in the past it was very significant because in the past, yes, both governments had their ups and downs, like sometimes their meetings would be cancelled, sometimes one party would not be there. Like our people, our government of ABC, Autonomous Bougainville government, would go over to Port Moresby and the national government would not be there to receive them. So this one was very significant on home soil of New Zealand, like New Zealanders put them there. It's very significant because there was dialogue, there was mutual understanding by both governments. So this needs to be continued. The understanding that they had in New Zealand should be continued. The dialogue that they had in New Zealand, where they trusted, where they respected each other, where they listened to both governments, listened to one another, it should be continued. That's the Melanesian way of doing things, the give and take. It's not only one party winning and the other one losing. No, it's very significant to us because that agreement paved the way for both governments to move forward, to progress what our people want.
The efforts for independence have been going on for a really long time now. Is this Melanesia agreement to you, is this finally some progress forward in the right direction?
Yes, this is finally some progress forward in the right direction. And we really would like to see both governments continue to progress this further positively for our people.
And that's Helen Hakena, Executive Director of Women's Development Agency in Bougainville and a long-time campaigner for peace and women's rights.
Newsroom Footy, hosted by me, Sam Wicks,
and me, Tenero Aruna. Each week, we'll bring you Pacific Islander stories from on and off the rugby league and rugby union field.
We'll have plenty of special guests, tales from the past, tackle the big topics of today, and look forward to the next-gen Nijin Footy Stars.
Nijin Footy. Nijin Footy.
Monday afternoons at 4 o'clock PNG time.
On ABC Radio Australia.
Tēnā koe and welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, a massive infrastructure project designed to provide clean water for the population of Timor-Leste's capital city, Dili, is in doubt as a result of US foreign aid cuts. The water and sanitation plan was at the heart of a $640 million package signed off with a US government development agency, but President Donald Trump's actions have led to that funding source being suspended. However, the Timorese government had promised to contribute $94 million, and as Vonya Vieira reports from Dili, it says it will do what it can to deliver the improvements the city's residents sorely need.
Delfina Martins lives 300 meters from Timor's biggest dam to the West Dili. The smoke from the burning waste gets so thick at times her children struggle to breathe. The garbage is also polluting their water supply, a well her family dug into the ground, which they use for drinking cooking and bathing.
We have been using water from my brother's house next door, but people did not tell us we have been drinking dirty water.
Bebonuk in west part in Dili, near to the beach. From Bebonuk to the central Dili, around 15 minutes. There, Domingo Suarez also draws water from a well from his family.
We use pump water. We use it for cooking, for washing dishes, for bathing and washing clothes.
The well there is around 5 meters deep, and the water also contaminated and dirty.
Water doesn't come out much. It comes out a little bit. Some is dirty water, but we use it every day.
Bebonuk was to be the location of Timor-Leste centralized sanitation and waste water treatment system to supply clean drinking water for around 500,000 people living in and around Dili. It was going to be built using part of a $640 million grant from the Millennium Challenges Corporation, an independent U.S. government development agency. The project was announced with mass celebration back in 2022. But another Bebonuk resident, Teresa da Silva, says there has been no news since then.
We heard the government is going to build a project on the coast, but until now, we've not heard any more. We heard they poured water into the tank and then distributed it to us, so we're happy. But now, no project.
A local entity called the Millennium Challenge Account Timor-Leste was set up to implement the project. Its executive director Constancio da Conceição Pinto confirms that the U.S. funding has been suspended.
After President Trump assumed his presidency, and his policy was to review the U.S. foreign assistance. And as a result of that, our activities has been suspended. But doesn't mean that it's end. Yeah. We are still here and we are waiting for the final decision.
Mr. Pinto says it's vital the project continues. He says waterborne diseases kill thousands of people every year.
A lot of people die, not only children, but also young people die at a young age. So we think that after this project, you know, Dili will be cleaner, the water will be safer for people to consume, and people will be healthier and be more productive in their work.
Mr. Pinto says the Timorese government still wants to deliver the project.
There's a full commitment to move this project forward because the government also thinks it is important this for us to have this project.
But exactly how that can be achieved, remind us, and clear us the water drown from wells the many of Dili residents depend on.
And that's Vanya Vieira reporting for Pacific Beat from Timor-Leste's capital city, Dili. Up next, it's your news wrap. Yes, kam na maru and welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm your host, Aki Tobo, and joining me in the studio this morning for your Monday morning, it is our producer, Carl Evans. How are you doing, sir?
I'm well, Aggie. Good weekend in sport with a thrilling game between the Wallabies and the Flying Fijians. So I'm looking forward to talking about that, I've got to say.
Love. I'm waiting to hear that too. But look, we have got a couple of stories from around the region. Up first, we've got Samoa's government. They've actually revealed what the future holds for the shipwreck, the HMNZS Manawanui.
That's right. So Prime Minister Fiamme Naomi Mata'afa has said the ship will not be excavated and will stay right where it is, which is at the bottom of a reef off the coast of Samoa, where it sunk last October. So the PM said the government were presented with a list of options regarding the wreck, excavation, I presume, being one of them. But it was decided that it was safe enough to leave where it is and basically just let nature take its course. This is despite the ship going down with fuel, oil and toxic elements on board. However, the PM says all of those toxic elements have now been removed.
Okay.
And the ship is essentially, Aggie, just part of the reef now and one of the latest addition to one of many, many shipwrecks throughout the Pacific Ocean.
Absolutely. I'm wondering, though, how have the locals taken the news?
Yeah, well, according to One News New Zealand, some are not happy at all. They've quoted some people from some nearby villages who say they are still living with the consequences of the ship sinking and want to see it taken away. They say it's damaged the reef, it's damaged the shores, the mangroves. And surprisingly, authorities are still maintaining a no-go zone around the site, meaning they still can't fish in the area, which leads you to believe that it's still dangerous in the area. However, the government disagrees and they seem to be happy with the cleanup effort. Well, and that's just the way it's going to be now, Aggie, going forward, I guess.
Yeah, okay. Well, let's head to Australia. Or, sorry, an Australian man has actually allegedly been caught with a vast amount of cocaine. In PNG, what happened there?
Yeah, that's right. So a 45-year-old man from New South Wales was apprehended in a hotel in Port Moresby last Tuesday, with police alleging he was in possession of 60 kilograms worth of drugs. He's currently being held in custody, with police expected to charge him with serious drug trafficking offences. The drugs, meanwhile, are estimated to be worth millions in street value. Wow. And police are working to determine, if he was acting alone or if he was part of a broader criminal network.
Well, meanwhile, though, I believe a further...
Allegedly acting alone, I should say.
Yes.
Sorry.
Thank you for that clarification. Meanwhile, though, I believe a further 2.5 tonnes of drugs has been seized in New Caledonia. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So according to the French High Commission, 2.5 tonnes of cocaine was found in a Panama-flagged vessel. So the ship had left Peru back in May and was actually headed to Australia, with the drugs packed in about 50 individual bags. Investigators believe that the drug shipment was prepared to be dispatched aboard small outboard vessels near the Australian coast. Currently the ship's 7 crew members have all been remanded in custody. So, some concerning news around transnational drugs in the Pacific at the moment.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's maybe go to some happier news. We've got sport, where the Flying Fijians have narrowly lost Australia by 3 points. Let's take a listen to how it all unfolded.
Well, hit and hope from Lomasia. To Fiji, they love it broken, and off goes the Nakai Vata. It's quick ball to the left. Here they come, running little. Back it goes, Rayasi. Rayasi! In Fiji, stun Australia right on half time. Can't get here. The try, well, is the try good? Yes. There's a siren. And Australia win.
Yeah, it was an epic game, Aggie. I've got to say, it really was. It was probably the best union game I've seen for quite a while. And Newcastle is just such a great, city for football as well. It's always such a great atmosphere there. Obviously, Wallabies captain Harry Wilson scoring that try in the dying seconds to get the Wallabies over the line, 21-18. Joy and relief is probably how I would describe the celebrations from the Wallabies in actually what was their first and only hit out before the upcoming British and Irish Lions series, which I'll actually be attending, which I'm very excited for. But look, to be honest, I think it was actually Fiji who people would have left talking about. Particularly after some of the tries they put on. That second try, as we heard in the audio before, set up by Wenikolo, that was an absolute screamer, to be honest. Made something just completely from nothing. I think in a lot of ways they deserved to win it, particularly being up by 4 points in the dying minutes. However, the Wallabies were able to find a way to dig themselves out and get over the line.
Wow. Okay, well, look, and in rugby league, the PNG Hunters, they've actually snapped a 3-game losing streak. What's happened there?
Yeah. Yes, finally back in the winners' books after what's been a pretty grim few weeks for the Hunters. Had a bye last weekend. I think they really needed that just to sort of recuperate and maybe do some soul searching. I'm not sure, but no, they knocked over the Townsville Blackhawks 34-16 in Port Moresby, much to the relief of many, I'm sure. Sonny Wabo, the returning fullback, he was the hero, scoring two tries. And the newcomer, Kaya Wayambi, he scored a try on debut. I'm not sure if you remember, but he was actually the guy that came over in that player swap with Morea. So, yeah, good to see him have a good game.
Wow. Okay, that is a lot that has been happening in the Pacific. But as always, Carl, I want to say karabua. Thank you for bringing our news up here on Pacific Beat.
Pacific Beat.
It is Independence Day in Solomon Islands. Today, marking 47 years of an anniversary since the island and nation became independent from British rule. Across the capital, Honiara, celebrations have commenced, and joining us to unpack the day is the ABC's reporter in Solomon Islands, Chris Narita Almanuleong, with that I say good fellow morning, Chrissy.
Good fellow morning, Aggie, and happy Independence Day to all Solomon Islanders listening in.
Absolutely. Well, again, it's a public holiday there in Souls. I mean, you're at this parade to commemorate this day. Could you just take us through the parade and what does it really represent?
Yes, well, that's right. I'm part of the parade now, caught up in traffic with the parade that's moving towards the National Stadium. But it's indeed a special day for Solomon Islanders. Solomon Islanders are marking 47 years of self-determination. And for this float parade here, around almost 100 vehicles that are part of it, all adorned in the Solomon Islands national colors, which is blue, yellow, and green. And you can hear right behind me sounds from some of the vehicles that's passing by. But there's a lot of celebration and excitement here this morning in Honiara. You can take a listen.
I was going to say what the atmosphere is like, but we can clearly hear. I mean, what else are you seeing?
It's really happening here. Yeah. This float parade, you know, it unifies government ministries, corporate companies, schools, and civil society. So they're all part of this float leading up to the National Stadium. It's one of the ways of showcasing unity through the lens of everyday Solomon Islanders. And as we pass by right now, Aggie, there's a sense of excitement here. I can see little kids with balloons of the Solomon flag just standing nearby, watching from the roadside. There's many other Solomon Islanders coming out in numbers to be able to be part of this whole celebration, Aggie.
Again, Chrissy, how significant is this day for Solomon Islanders?
It's quite significant, Aggie. 47 years ago, our forefathers and leaders, they united in their vision and decision for this country to be independent, for the Union Jack to be lowered and the Solomon Islands flag to be hoisted instead. But over the 47 years of independence, Solomon Islanders have tasted the sweetness of triumph, bitterness of adversity, and the country has gone through its challenges as well. Many can recall the ethnic tensions and the challenges that came with it. A lot of differences as well here in this land of almost a million people scattered across 900 islands, Aggie. But the country is slowly progressing to where its future is destined for joy, peace, and progress. I know a lot of sounds and noise coming in right at the background, but it's huge significance to many Solomon Islanders that I've spoken to this early. It's a time for them to also reflect and come together to celebrate the common grounds, to reflect on how this country has shaped and the future, you know, progressing. But we have also heard from Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele, who in a Thanksgiving service yesterday, a part of the national independence celebrations, he's reminded Solomon Islanders for peace and prosperity, for opportunities to grow and thrive as well as one people. And let's take a listen to what he had to say.
I call on every Solomon Islander to strive for unity, create new relationships, mending those that may have fallen to disrepair, and amending those relationships that may no longer be appropriate. We need to do this at all levels, from our homes to our communities, from our nation to other nations. Similarly, I call on our leaders to unite our people.
Mm. Well, Chrissy, I mean, look, the main event will happen after the parade. Can you let us know who will be present and what's expected to happen?
Well, everyone is now headed to the National Stadium, part of this float parade, where the main independence program is expected to happen. This independence program will also see the Royal Solomon Islands Police Force and uniform groups also parading at the National Stadium itself. So a little bit more on that is happening this morning. Across the in Honiara itself, music concerts. There's a trade fair that's just revived after 11 years, rather. And there's so many other activities for Solomon Islanders today just to remind them of how far the country has gone and for Solomon Islanders to reflect also on the journey that the country has taken. But yes, there'll be a lot more activities happening throughout the day, and it's one of those special day and insignificant one for Solomon Islanders.
Absolutely. And Chrissy, I just want to say tagia tumas and look, happy Independence Day to all our Solomon Islanders. I remember being at the National Stadium, so I know it's going to be a lot of fun this morning. So go and enjoy.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Aggie.
No worries. That is our ABC reporter in Solomon Islands, Krishnarita Almanu Leong, here on Pacific Beat.
What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is no one talking about PNG's political refugee crisis?
I can't even call it an election. It was something like a criminal thug war.
Join me, Scott Whitey, as I chat all things Pacific politics on Polytalk.
Tuesday, 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Vinaka Fakalevu, welcome back to Pacific Beat. Now, the Sprint King and Queens of the Pacific Mini Games in Balao were crowned over the weekend, with the 100-metre and women's athletics final taking place on Saturday night. PNG's Pine Swissel claimed gold for PNG in the men, while Australia's Kaedel Smith beat out PNG's Isla Upcup in the women. Action continues today with the Games Showcase event baseball set to conclude later today in a gold medal showdown between Guam and home nation Palau. But as for the ABC's Declan Burner and Sam Wykes, their time in Palau is finished, but not before some deep reflection on their mini games experience.
We've arrived in Brisbane from Palau. The dream is over for us, at least. Still a couple of days left of the Pacific mini games in Koror, but we are back on Australian soil. So we just thought we'd have a quick chat here. Sammy, let's go highlight off the pitch first, away from the sport.
The dream is over, isn't it? That's, I think, what was my highlight away from, I guess, the on-field action was just all the athletes getting together, just seeing them walk up and down the street, seeing them all together, meeting one another, and, you know, saying something that they love about, you know, learning even to say hello in Fiji and in Tongan, or just really embracing, you know, all the off-field camaraderie that you'd love to see. So I thought that was pretty special, especially the opening ceremony where we saw that in full force, where all the teams ran out into the field in the pouring down rain. So I thought that was the highlight for me.
I'm going to jump off the back of that, pretty similar one. But at the pool, whenever there was a race which featured a smaller nation, you know, without as many resources, that last person to finish, they might have been a lap, two laps behind, they got the biggest cheer out of all. The winning cheer was big, but a couple of times there was a PNG swimmer who it happened to, and the roar was massive. Every team that was sitting there on one side was cheering. All the fans on the other side were cheering. So, yeah, a great example of why the games is more than just what happens in the pool or on the track. It's about the getting together of all those cultures. What do you think it did for Palau on the whole in terms of a boost for their people and their sporting aspirations?
I thought you were going to say tourism, because mate, some of the pictures that will come back from those games, crystal clear waters. But I just think as a island nation, they've got the capacity to host more games. I think that's what it does for all the other Pacific Island nations as well. Like, there's an opportunity to have facilities, like pretty much world-class facilities in some events, you know, and what that will do for the people on the island as well. They can now aspire, because now they've seen it firsthand, all these athletes come into their country and seeing them compete and represent their family, their culture, and what that does for all the local talent. Because I want to experience that at some point. So, yeah, it creates aspiration, but it also allows for other Pacific Island nations to know maybe we can put our hand up and host the games as well.
Yeah, a lot of those venues weren't world-class venues. They were gyms or halls or school facilities that were turned into, I mean, the 3-on-3 basketball was one. That was certainly not, you know, something you would see at Olympic level, but they get it done, they make it work, and you see the crowd going crazy for it. It doesn't matter where it was being held. You could see that spirit and that competitiveness. Also loved hearing from the triathlete teams and the organisers in particular, who said, we managed to train and qualify 8 local Palauans now who can be technical delegates. They can help races happen in Palau and anywhere across the Pacific. They'll go to triathlon events around the world now. And they said that's the biggest boost for them, is we've empowered these people in Palau, which feels like a good legacy for the games as well. And yeah, you mentioned the fact that Palau now goes, okay, we can host it. Pretty much it felt like the whole country was involved in this. Like if they weren't athletes, they were volunteers. If they weren't volunteers, they were there cheering every single event.
Yeah, you're not wrong. And everyone plays a part in making those games happen. And you hit the nail on the head there, where it's not just about the athletes having an opportunity to compete. It's the other bit as well, where now organisers understand, okay, I can actually go from the mini games to the Pacific Games to potentially the Olympics and apply my experience there. You can have that on your resume now. We spoke to Joy, one of the leader of all the comms there, and just she was empowering all of our Pacific Island leaders in whatever department they were to make sure that they have everything in place to make sure the games are run efficiently. So there's an opportunity for, yeah, again, people to learn from so it can get better.
We had Sheridan Graham Tupaia on Nation Footy recently, and I know one question you asked her was, what about all the people who aren't good at sport but love sport and want to be involved? And that was sort of another example of it, is that there are so many people now. We saw a photographer who was 10 years old down at the pool, and he was just obsessed. He would have taken, you know, 10,000 photos across the week, and now he's probably dreaming of taking photos at the next Pacific Games or the Comm Games or Olympics. So, yeah, all those things outside of sport seem hopefully to be something bigger.
And that's ABC's Declan Byrne and Sam Wanks reflecting on their time in Palau at the Pacific Mini Games.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
Well, Fiji, it's known as a popular destination for weddings, for international visitors and locals alike. But the reality is, the country itself has seen a rising decline in marriages in Fiji. According to the Fiji Bureau of Statistics, over 6,000 unions were registered in 2024, down from 9,500 in 2016. So what is behind the decline? We're joined by this morning to get a better understanding of this is Professor and Chair of Social Work and Policy Studies at the University of Sydney, Dr. Georgi Ravulo. With that, I say welcome, Doctor.
Nissan Bulavanaka and g'day. Hi, how are you?
I am well. Doctor, thank you so much for joining us. Very interesting topic that we're going to be talking about. Look, we understand, right, that the social practice of marriage itself in the Pacific is, you know, often viewed as a cornerstone to our culture. But look, we're looking at Fiji. They're facing quite a stark decline in marriages. Should we be worried?
Yes and no. Like, no, in the sense of, I think what this represents is a broader understanding that marriage is not necessarily the ultimate goal in a relationship. And I think this is what we're seeing more and more in Fiji and across the Pacific. One of the reasons being is there's so much more information made available these days via different methods like the internet, obviously, through Google, but also social media. And as Pacific people, as Fijians, we have better access to these particular areas of information and knowledge. And I think people are starting to explore and see the world differently.
Well, yeah, and from those figures that I had mentioned, look, that's about, 3,000 less marriages in the last 8 years. Do you know what sort of factors would have played into that?
Well, the relationship stuff is also a big commitment for people coming through, especially the younger generation. And I think the younger generation, because we are living in a time where we want the here and now, I think people are not necessarily planning for the bigger picture future. And I think that's what was happening previously with marriage. Marriage was always seen as the ultimate goal. It was where you were going to settle down and have children and raise them in a beautiful home and all those sort of things. And that still happens today, very much so, but marriage is not necessarily seen as a part of that per se. I think there is the scope for people to still get married and still express their faith and their religion through those particular ceremonies and through those particular moments in time. But I believe that what we're seeing is more younger people seeing that marriage is not necessarily the ultimate goal, that you can have all those other things, the children and the home, without actually having to get married.
Yeah, I want to get into that a little bit more. But before that, do you think any of the following factors, you know, I know we went through COVID, there's often, you know, stories of domestic violence, or even our workers, you know, those who are going into the PALM scheme. Do you think those have played into the decline in marriages?
I think that can contribute. I think that there is those factors that are playing out and across the area and the region itself. You know, there are concerns around people in you know, intimate partner violence, but there's also stuff with people coming for seasonal workers opportunities. But from what I've seen in the conversations that I've had with Fijians, is a lot of the time it's about then also having the opportunity to do what you would like to do. So I don't think it's about the fear of commitment. It's just they want to live life. They want to do it in a way that is what they want, as opposed to what potentially the family and the culture traditionally wants. And I think that's what we're seeing more and more. We're seeing more of a modern take on relationships as opposed to the other factors.
Yeah, well, and let's talk about social norms, right? They often change, whether generationally, and you mentioned young people. So what is it that's sort of changing their minds about, you know, traditional versus modern?
I think a lot of it is to do also with the cost of living and finances. I think our younger generations have seen the way in which their own parents have had to even struggle financially to make ends meet. So I think for them, it's not necessarily about trying to lock themselves into those particular areas of life so quickly. I think they want to explore the world. I think they want to get out there and do things, and they don't necessarily want to settle down so quickly. In conversations I've even had with some my Fijian colleagues at work, they've said things like, yes, I've got younger children that are, you know, adults, young adults, and they don't want to necessarily go into relationships long term. They want to go out and have fun in all different ways, if you know what I mean, and they don't necessarily want to commit to anything at this stage.
Well, when you talk about that, you know, the rising cost of living, I must say, you know, when we look at the economic challenges, right, like how much of an impact then would this have on the economy there in Fiji?
I know that people, as you mentioned in the opening package, I know that a lot of people do come to Fiji to celebrate their wedding. And I think that's an important part of tourism in Fiji. And I think that will continue to happen. A lot of people will still come to Fiji to celebrate and be with their family and friends to do that. I think, though, going back to the local context, I think that a lot of the time people are going to do their own thing. They're not necessarily having the big opulent weddings that a lot of people from outside Fiji do. They're not necessarily coming in and bringing in all the tourism that goes with that. So I don't think there's necessarily any concerns with that per se. I think it's more just around them living their best lives, moving forward, knowing that they can still achieve and have those other things later on. But I think not necessarily now is a big part of their thinking. And again, this is more the younger people, the younger generations. In the counselling that I do with couples, you know, there's still a lot of stuff that they are wanting to achieve. A lot of the couples, the Pacific couples that I deal with, they're not necessarily married, they're in de facto long-term loving relationships, but marriage hasn't necessarily been part of their journey and something that they're not necessarily considering, because they're still happy with each other, they're still happy with their family that they're actually rearing through young children. And I think that's what they're focused on, is just being able to survive and thrive through that.
Well, and we've spoken a lot about the younger generation, but, you know, again, with the counselling and the people that you see, how have you seen the older generation? You know, people are either maybe not wanting to get married younger, but are waiting until they're a little bit older. Is that the case at all?
Yeah, I've seen some of that as well, but I think that's the other thing. I think people will also develop a sense of connection to themselves and others. As they get older, they become a lot more comfortable and they become a lot more aware of who they are and what they want in life. And I think, yes, if they want to get married, they do that because they understand that is something that they would like to do, as opposed to potentially pressure from peers and family. And so, yeah, I think with the older generation, and you are seeing still that arrangement occur. But again, it's based on people wanting to do it because they are more aware of what they want individually and collectively.
And I think even if we talk about, you know, the decline in marriages, but you also deal with people who are maybe constantly either just breaking up from a marriage, right? Like, do you, how was that? Yeah, how was that when you were dealing with them?
Yeah, that can be really tricky, especially because we know that the family is so nuclear for Pacific families. And I think that can always be a hard thing to navigate for Pacific couples, especially as they may have children involved, and then the need to make sure that they are the priority when it comes to ensuring that there is the ongoing care for them. But I think that's something that they are still trying to navigate, this idea of how do we now relate to each other based on no longer being together, but still having these children as part of that shared journey. I think that's an ongoing thing that we all need to talk about. I think that's the key thing really here, is that we need to make sure that we are having these conversations about relationships. I know generally we don't talk about relationships, especially intimacy in relationships. And I'm not suggesting that we do that publicly, but we still need to have those conversations.
I think this is the reason why we have these conversations on the show, is to be able to address this issue. And talking about addressing this issue then, well, how do we approach it to be able to support people's choices, you know, if they want to marry or not?
Well, to encourage those particular choices to be had in the first place, I think it's really, really important that we provide scope for us to talanoa, to have that individually, even collectively, to create those sort of conversations in a way that people feel like they're able to express their authentic selves. And we know that when you're able to share and hold space and even, you know, nurture and ensure that the vaap, the sacred spaces between us, is nurtured in a way that is helpful, then people feel comfortable to have those conversations with each other. So I think that's what's really, really important. We continue to do that. We continue to also share, you know, some of those things where appropriate on socials. But I'm talking more around health, ensuring that we are creating health literacies, making sure that people are aware of what it means to be in happy, healthy relationships, so that we are counteracting gender-based violence, domestic and family violence, intimate partner violence. So a lot of those things also need to occur as part of our shared conversation.
I have to ask then, happy, healthy relationships, so what really does that look like?
For me, when I'm talking with the couples that I work with in counselling, it really is about ensuring that we're encouraging people to communicate their expectations with each other. I'm always very surprised when I'm sitting in space with individuals and they might go, oh, yes, this is what I want from my partner. And I'm like, well, have you spoken to them about it? And they're like, no. And it's like, okay, let's encourage that particular conversation to be had. And so a lot of my sessions then will encourage both parties, the partners, to actually have that shared conversation. I'll facilitate that shared conversation safely so they feel comfortable. And once they start doing that, they then can start to feel comfortable in sharing other things as part of their shared journey together. So I think that's the key thing. Share expectations, communicate expectations. It can be verbally, it can even be written, but it's just about being able to create that space. Again, even the VAR in a intimate relationship that encourages those conversations around expectations.
Beautiful. Doctor, it is always great to catch up with you and just to hear some great advice for those who may be considering marriage, especially there in Fiji. But look, again, I want to say vinaka vakalevu. Thank you so much for your time.
Naka.
And that is Professor of Social Work and Policy Studies at the University of Sydney, Dr. Georgi Ravulo, here on Pacific Beat. And that brings us to the end of a Pacific Beat. Time to take a look back at one of our main stories today. Recapping, delegates from around the world arrive in Jamaica for the International Seabed Authority Assembly, where regulations for deep sea mining may be finalised.
Our goal and the work that we have done sets a standard for a really robust analysis of deep sea communities and deep sea mining, so that if deep sea mining does occur, it'll be underpinned by science-based management and monitoring.
And that's research scientist Dr. Pierce Dunstan there. Well, we'll be back at the same time tomorrow at 6 a.m. PNG time. You can hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. But stay tuned because your news is next, and coming up after that, it is Nisha Daily. I say karabua, tikarai ambong. Have a great day. Until next time, I say otua ofatu. This is Pacific Beat, yours in the Pacific.
Salo Falava, I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Raiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.